Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Is everyone awake and ready?
Awake and ready.
Great. Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother. Saints and sages of all religions. I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. It is with great bliss that I hear today, and so wonderful to have this satsang. Sat is the eternal self, sang is association, connection with. So both externally we come together to worship God, and we also come to be drawn up within our own kingdom of heaven, within ourselves. These last 2 weeks of Master's Maha Samadhi anniversary is Master has taken me up in his wings and flown me into heavenly realms. He described at one point how when he met with Babaji, Babaji gave him an illuminating touch in which Master was lifted up into the consciousness of Babaji. It's an interesting thing. We're told not to worship idols. And so in some religions, there's absolutely no representation of God. In some, there is a cross up in the front, or perhaps a crucifix with Jesus affixed to the cross in the crucified manner. In other religions, you see many, many different images. In Hinduism, you see so many hundreds and thousands of images and portrayals of God. And that for some religions, this would be absolutely wrong. But in Hinduism, which is oftentimes described as polytheistic, at its heart is always a monotheistic philosophy, religion, aspiration to attain that oneness with God, that there is only one and there is no other. But images, saints, and realized beings are all seen as conduits, ways to approach God. They are not meant to stand as a barrier between you and the infinite, but rather, with our human minds, we need something to be able to fixate our mind upon. We operate from a human standpoint as a subject and an object. You are the subject. The object is whatever you place your mind upon. And so you operate in duality from that standpoint. And you have to learn to affix your mind to something. It may be an image. It may be the ajna, the third eye point, or any other particular point or aspect that you meditate, you concentrate on. And meditation begins with concentration. So if we learn about the life of a spiritually realized master, we feel the vibration, we feel the upliftment, because they themselves were in that uplifted state of consciousness. And so when you think on them and you connect with them, you feel the purity of that uplifted consciousness. It uplifts and purifies your consciousness. And that is the purpose and the reason for focusing upon the lives and the spirit of any realized master or saint. And through that purification and that upliftment, you are drawn into your own heavenly kingdom. As Master said, you cannot have Yogananda consciousness. You can only gain your own God consciousness. However, through attunement with the spiritual master, you are drawn into those highest kingdoms within yourself. So that is the magic, you might say, in focusing on lives and symbols that are, so to speak, outside of yourself, that are an image of God, and you take it as an image of God until you have gone through the purification rite in which you rise beyond duality or subject and object. You rise beyond your own human mind, and you enter into that divine consciousness. So with that in mind, in thinking on Master, I thought I would read today the last speech given by Yoganandaji. And this was delivered at the Hotel Biltmore on March 1952. And in many years before, Divine Mother, Master had said, had told him that he would see that India would be free of any foreign rule within his lifetime. And this was a long-held wish, of course, by those who were native Indians and many others as well. And Gandhiji was such a huge portion and part of that. And he demonstrated to the world that there was another way to interact politically in order to gain freedom, and that it was a nonviolent means, and that he worked very, very hard with everything in his body, mind, and soul to be able to make that a nonviolent revolution. And so it must have been with such deep gratification and joy that Master was invited to speak at the Ambassador of India coming for the first time to Los Angeles area, and that he was able to speak before the Ambassador was to speak. And it was there that Divine Mother chose to have Master drop his form. And so at the very end of the speech, there have been some who have questioned, why didn't he go into samadhi while he was sitting in lotus posture and so on, as some kind of form of criticism of Master. But as the end of the speech, there's a commentary, and I think it will make clear why Master did what he did. So the Master begins, Your Excellency, our Ambassador, illustrious and understanding Ambassador of Free India, I bow to God in you. I am not here in an advisory capacity, so I will relate a few snatches of my experiences. I remember my meeting with Mahatma Gandhi, the great prophet, brought a practical method for peace to the warring modern world. Gandhi, who for the first time applied Christ's principles to politics and won freedom for India, gave an example that would be followed by all nations to solve their troubles. You, Your Excellency, represent the great spiritual India. I wish that you bring the very best of my India to my America, and take the very best of my America to my India. But that is a very difficult task, no doubt. For in this world, nations and men are all a little bit crazy. And they don't know it. Because people with the same kind of craziness mix together. But when differently crazy people get together and compare notes, they find out their particular craziness. Indeed, Your Excellency can discover the goodness of different nations. I think if we would gather together the great men of all lands, we could build such a model civilization that all nations would eventually form a United States of the world, with God guiding them through their conscience. India has great things to give to you, as you Americans can very greatly help India. But we often concentrate on our faults and not on our good qualities. I remember that when I first came to America in 1920, I was warned, never go into dark alleys, lest my scalp be removed by Red Indians. And whenever I saw a bald-headed man, I thought some Indians had been at work. I remember, too, that when I first came here, I was riding one day to the seashore when I noticed some hot dog signs. In imagination, I saw all kinds of dogs going through the meat chopper. And I thought, my Lord, why did you bring me to this land where people eat dogs? I asked a man who was inside those mysterious, what was inside those mysterious bags, and he said, pork and beef. I gasped in relief to find that Americans don't eat dogs. One morning, I was passing by an empty field next to a store. That evening, as I passed the same way again, I saw the house standing in the field. I inquired of a man if the house had been there in the morning. No, he replied, they just put it up. When I think of such energy, I like to be an American. But when I hear of so many American millionaires who die prematurely after making business success, then I like to be a Hindu, to sit by the banks of the Ganges, concentrate on the factory of mind from which spiritual skyscrapers can come, and to think of the great masters of India who are her glory. Somewhere between the two great civilizations of efficient America and spiritual India lies the answer for a model world civilization. It seems there is plenty of money for war, which brings in its wake great sufferings. We don't seem to learn from these. If we have plenty of money for wholesale killings, couldn't we picture the possibility that if all the big leaders and all the peoples got together, they could collect a vast fund that would banish poverty and ignorance from the face of the globe? I do hope and pray, Your Excellency, that you will always emphasize the airplanes of mercy from one country to another, instead of airplanes that carry bombs to destroy. Let us work for peace on Earth as never before. We want a Congress of scientists, of ambassadors, of religious men who will constantly think how to make the world a better home, a spiritual home, with God as our guide. I am proud that I was born in India. I am so proud that we have a great ambassador representing my spiritual India. I am proud today. I often say, if mortal fires raise all her homes in golden paddy fields, yet to sleep on her ashes and dream immortality, O India, I will be there. God made the earth, and man made his confining countries and their fancy frozen boundaries. For Ganges, woods, Himalayan caves, and men dream God, I am hallowed, my body touched that sod. With these last words from his poem, My India, Paramahansaji slid to the floor, a beatific smile on his face. He had often said, I do not wish to die in bed, but with my boots on, speaking of God and India. And something that I wrote from yesterday. These past 2 weeks spent working on the description of the days leading up to the Mahasamadhi of Paramahansa Yogananda has taken me into a feeling of loving closeness with the Master that is wonder-filled. His God-centered personality shines through the descriptions by the various people, giving glimpses into his very divine moods and ways that he lived his life. One simply cannot measure a spiritual master by outward signs, although those signs may give a hint of his or her inner glory. We'd love to hear stories of any great saint, but to hear the story alone is a bit like looking into a room from the other side of a glass window. Nice, but not the same as being in the room itself. To enter the room where Master dwells means to enter deeply into your yogi's cave of meditation and deep communion with God. In a world of suffering and isolation, it comes as a great amazement to find that right within your own consciousness lays a treasure trove of union with the eternal, all-blissful consciousness of God. Without the clarion call of great souls who have themselves discovered the greatest of open secrets, who would guess at this truth? This world acts as a maze of 1,000 turns that keeps us from the hidden goal. However, these same great knowers of God that tell us about the glowing kingdom within also give us the means for traversing the maze quickly and safely. Master came to make you know that with intelligent use of your will, you can jumpstart your journey. Instead of plodding steps, you may fly to your goal. A lofty promise, great words, and a moving testimony from his own life and experience that is proof of this truth. In order to fulfill that promise, we must apply the same principles with the same vigor as the great master did. We may doubtfully look through the glass window and say, well, that is all right for him. He is exceptional, but not for such a one as I. This is delusion's voice hissing to you that you cannot attain what Master accomplished. However, we must take our cue from the great Master's life, attitude, and love for God, and strive for God as he strove. Love as he loved. Be willing to shake heaven and earth to uncover the treasure trove. Let us so transform our lives that we feel that we are living as kindred spirits with all the great spiritual masters. Mother felt that Master was so great that he was Christ come again. Boldly dare to claim your kinship with these great masters. Be inspired by Master's life and example, and know the open secret in the world, the greatest open secret in the world. It's been a very moving time for me as I have transcribed these writings that come from Mother's Library about Master's last days. And it gives so many insights into the great spiritual master's life, what it was like living with him from day to day. As it was described that they tiptoed in the next room so as to not to disturb Master when he was deeply indrawn. That there is times when he went out to the desert and he spent long periods out there writing and giving so much of himself, and yet in that time and time of activity, he was also suffering a great deal in the body. There were times when they had to carry him in a chair in order to get him up to a podium or a platform. There's times when they wheeled him around in a wheelchair because it was so painful in him, in his legs. And Mother described that she thought perhaps it was really in those last couple of years that he completed all the way the mystical crucifixion. Now, to some, that would come as heresy, to think that Master had not fully accomplished everything in terms of conscious union with God beforehand. But he himself described where at one point someone is going to take a picture, and he said, just a moment, and then he withdrew himself into Nirvikalpa Samadhi. And so with that, he indicated that he was not yet in that complete and total union with God, Sahaja Samadhi, or as he called it, Nirvana, Brahma Nirvana. And so there are these steps that go. It doesn't take away from the greatness of any great spiritual master or any great saint. Now, it was his to come as a public personality, that he wanted to draw so many people to him. And I remember a story of when he was back in India in 1935 and 36, and he started a meditation group in Calcutta. And there were some who came, a handful of people came, and he was always one who wanted to bring in more. And so he told everybody there that if they did not bring another, at least one other person with them the next week when they met, that he would not take of the prasad that was being offered. He would deny himself that. And so it came as a motivation that everybody would bring another person. And of course, instantly you double your congregation. And if you do that each week, pretty soon you have a large group. This is his personality. It was expansive. It was big. It was all-inclusive. He wanted to draw everyone into God in this way. And saw it as the greatest product. His mother said, one time somebody said to her, "You're the greatest salesperson I've ever met in my life." And she says, "That's because I have the greatest product. And that is God." So when you think about that, and you think about what this has to offer, what this journey, what this path that is taught from the very highest state of consciousness, that has been brought into inception from the very great spiritual personalities of Jesus and Babaji, and from there Lari Mahasaya, who is a quiet personality, but believe me, so great in God, Sri Yukteswarji, who just shines through the pages of the autobiography of a yogi, and through all of Master's life, through Master himself, who is such a delightful, wonderful personality, and so much lifted up in God, and so God-oriented, and Mother, who had attained that complete and total union with God. These are the headwaters of grace, of intelligence, of life that flow down to us. And to think with great value, you know, once we get exposed to something, sometimes we can go through a honeymoon period. And we're just so taken up with the teachings and with the life. We're inspired. We feel in bliss. We feel uplifted all the time. And then gradually, because our intensity begins to die down, our experience of God begins to come down as well. And then we have to dig in for the deep work, because the ego raises its head. Papa and Mataji both oftentimes talked about that people come to the ashram, they come with all these good intentions, and yet they slowly get integrated into the ashram, and pretty soon they're finding fault. And they're talking about this person, and their intensity for God gradually begins to wane. And then Mataji would tell people, "You've been coming here to this ashram for so many years, and you're not getting your realization. What's wrong with you? Wake up. Get it. Now." See, she would be fierce like that. And sometimes we need that. As Roy Eugene Davis said, we need a living guru, because sometimes we need to get kicked in the butt. And it's true. It's true. We need to wake up. We can't go into default mode, where we just kind of cruise along in our life, acting and pretending as if there is nothing greater in life. There's nothing greater to attain to. In my own journey, I have bumped up against those times when it feels like perhaps I, even though I'm feeling God, perhaps that's it. Perhaps that's all there is. And it's wonderful what I'm getting. And then suddenly I wake up to the fact this is pure delusion speaking to me. This is the ego that is trying to lull me back into complacency. And it doesn't bring the sharpness of awareness of what I need to do. We need to exhibit the same passion, the same determination that Master exhibited, that Mother exhibited, that Papa exhibited, not to be lukewarm. That's the hardest place to get a person out of. Even if you're cold, sometimes we read the stories of great saints Valmiki was one such as these. And he is a terrible person. A terrible person. He robbed people. He killed them. He enjoyed it. And then one day, Narada, who had come down from heaven and he was walking along, and Valmiki met him and he recognized something different in this great man of God that he had never met before. And it drew him in. And he realized the futility of everything that he was doing. He knew that he needed and wanted exactly what this spiritual master had. And he set about to do it. He let go of everything of his old life. And he just started to concentrate on the name Ram. Ram, Ram, Ram. And he became so deeply indrawn, it is said that ants build an ant pile. You see this in India where these are 6 foot tall ant piles. And these, they built it of mud all around him, and he didn't even care. He is just so indrawn. He is completely one with God. And one day, Narada was walking along the path once again, came along to this ant pile, and he broke it all apart, and there sitting inside was his now illumined spiritual master. After that, he went by the name of Valmiki, which means ant pile, because that's where he is found. It was like a cocoon in him that allowed this complete and total transformation. And he broke it apart and he said, come, there's something for you to do in this world. Valmiki said, no, 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 no. He says, just let me meditate here. This world is a terrible place. What do I want with it? I just want to remain immersed in God right where I am. Narada said, no, 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 you have something to do. You must fulfill this. There is a great spiritual personality, an incarnation of God you are about to meet. And he will show you what a true God-man can be living in this world, but not of this world. And that spiritual personality that he was eventually to meet was Ram or Rama, just depending on what the pronunciation of it. And from there, he went out and he played a very important role in this incarnation of God's life as he went about fulfilling what he had come to do. So it doesn't make any difference what kind of a background we have, how horrible we've been. We have all skeletons in our closet, either from this lifetime or from others. There have been times, and God has reminded me, of other lifetimes where I have played every despicable role. And if I used that as an excuse not to go to him, then I would just be doing that. I would be using it as an excuse. Everybody's past is littered with skeletons and things you would prefer not to remember. But out of the remembrance of it, we can take away one little bit of wisdom. And that is, no matter what we've had in this lifetime, it doesn't lead to the lasting happiness that we're yearning for. We have striven, we have tried to gain it in every possible manner. And then we come to that point of realization, nothing in this world makes a difference. I have seen lifetimes when I have wielded great worldly power over a lot of people, and I was in complete isolation and aloneness and misery. I had tremendous wealth, and it didn't make any difference, you see. And it's like I had to go through those experiences to really embed it in me that none of those things will lead to total happiness. As the saying goes, uneasy is the head upon which the crown rests. And it is true. It is true. It is filled with problems. It is filled with stress. It has its things that it brings to it. But it does not lead to that lasting happiness. That has been proven to me. And so, in my own life, as I followed these teachings, we have these variety of expressions. Lhari Mahasaya, who lived very simply, he was an office worker. He had a home. He had a wife. He had children. To all outward appearances, he was a very ordinary person. And I love the story of one time when he went into the bank and he was going to make a deposit. And only someone who's tried to make a deposit in India knows what a lengthy process that can be. And you're given a little token with a number on it. At least that's how it happened for me. And then you go over to a bench and you sit. And so naturally the great master went over to sit and wait his turn. And he just started meditating, and suddenly he was drawn up into the spine, into the higher brain, and he's just merged into oneness with God, and the world just dropped away. Well, time passed, and he didn't even realize it. He's totally immersed in God consciousness and the bliss of God. Finally, when he came down into body consciousness and his eyes began to open, he looked around and he saw that the bank was completely empty except for the employees. And the bank had gone past its normal closing time. And the manager of the bank knew something of Lhari Mahasaya. And he said, oh, this is a great spiritual master here. It's a blessing for us to be here and meditate with him while he's immersed in such a way. So they closed and locked the doors. And they all sat there with the master, getting blessings from him. Well, when Lhari Mahasaya came down, he opened his eyes and he saw that the bank is closed and he had kept all these people past their normal working time. He felt very embarrassed about that. And he apologized and they assured him there is nothing for him to apologize about, that they had enjoyed their time with him. And then not only did they sit and meditate with him, but they completed his transaction too. And then he went upon his way. But to all outward appearances, he was an ordinary person. And then Sri Yukteswar, who for so many years lived as an ordinary householder life, and then because he was of Kshatriya, and Brahmins did not feel comfortable coming to his Gita teachings, and they would like to come, but once you become a Swami, then your old caste affiliations are cast off and they would be free to be able to come. And so Sri Yukteswar took on the orange robe because that allowed those who would like to come to come. Other than that, he continued to lead, you might say, an ordinary householder life. He lived in his two homes that he had, and he had a very beautiful home that he got that was on his seaside in Puri, and another home that was near the banks of the Ganges. And he continued on in this way, and he's taught to small groups. And oftentimes he had a couple of young boys who were there who were in training. And he used his own funds, and he made those funds stretch, and so that he could accommodate everybody. And then Master burst onto the scene. And everywhere that he went, it seemed, from a child, any time that he would discover a saint, he would want all of his friends to come and see that saint. And he would gather his friends together, and they would meditate together. And they discovered a kind of a burned-out home, and they adopted that, and that became their dharmashala, their place of meditation and worship. And so he's always drawing people to him. He wanted everybody to come to God with him. It was just his nature. And so when he graduated from high school and then college, at college, he would always bring all of his chums, all of his friends with them to see Sri Yukteswar. But very few of them came and stayed because somewhat of Sri Yukteswar's aloof nature. And also when Master would come, oftentimes Sri Yukteswar, right in front of his friends and everybody, would start talking about some of Master's faults. That's a tough thing, you know. You bring your friends and suddenly you're on the head of the pin. And it's happening right in front of God and everybody. But Master was absolutely glued to Sri Yukteswar. And even though his friends didn't come and stay, He was always wanting to bring his friends in, always wanting to get them to have this good stuff, this honey that he was getting from his beloved master. It was not that long of a period of time before Sri Yukteswar gave that liberating experience to Master. And he entered into that wonderful state of samadhi where he merged his consciousness into God consciousness. How to describe this? He does through his own poem, Samadhi. And yet it's difficult to convey it, because if you've not experienced it, you're always looking at it through the filter of your own mind that has limitations. It always operates in that subject-object realm, and it's difficult to imagine yourself being merged into this unending, ever-new, blissful state. And it feels that you're merging yourself into a universal state of consciousness, that there are no barriers, there are no limits, there are no edges to it. It just is expansive beyond belief. That it's filled with bliss. It's filled with light. And so he learned how to release himself from body consciousness, and by focusing his attention upon the ajna, and exiting out of the body, so to speak. You don't really exit out of the body, because the body is part of everything as well. You see? But you become so immersed in divine consciousness, in bliss consciousness, that the body seems to be just a dream, if you're aware of it at all. You're aware, perhaps, that you have a body, but it doesn't feel quite real to you. What feels real to you, more real than any other experience you've ever had in this world, is this emergence into God, is this bliss, is this light, is this expanded awareness, is the wisdom thoughts that come to you. And that surpasses every worldly experience to such a degree that you feel that this world is false, that your absorption in this world has prevented you from seeing divine consciousness. And so in the state of jnani, you say the world is false and God alone is real. And then as you come back into this material body again, and you once again are aware, because you need that awareness to be able to operate in this world, in the beginning, your consciousness comes back down. You're in a human state of consciousness. Perhaps you are still pervaded with that bliss that you've just recently been immersed in. But as Master described the first time emerging into it, when he came back into body consciousness, it was a crushing thing that his omniscient spirit was once more crammed into this little body consciousness. And how hard, how difficult that was for him. But then Sri Yukteswar said, come, let us get a broom and sweep. And to learn to carry that bliss consciousness with him, even as he went about ordinary activities. And gradually, he got to where he could enter in from this sabbakalpa state to this nirbhikalpa state. And in nirbhikalpa, you are now, there's more of a blend between that interior state of bliss and being in body consciousness. And yet there is still times there is a barrier between you and the divine. And so finally, you go over the top, as Mother says, in that final crucifixion. There's the three stages of mystical crucifixion of the body, of the astral body, and finally the idea or the causal body. And it is in this causal body that there is still a thin veil between you and the infinite. And that thin veil finally is erased. And now you're completely merged in divine consciousness. And when you come back down into this body consciousness, there is no more separation. As I've described it, it's like a surgeon's glove that the hand has slipped into. And the glove is the body, and the hand is God operating through you and through your three levels of personality, your causal, your astral, and your physical. And so now there is no separation. It is simply God acting through all three of your forms. But you not only see it through your own three forms, but it's universalized. You now have the universal vision, and you see that God is manifesting through everyone. That everyone is like the surgeon's glove. Only some people have big, thick winter gloves on. And that is a thick material consciousness and wedded to this world and wedded to this body. But gradually, as you go through this transformation, the glove becomes thinner and more transparent. And gradually you come to that point where only God shines through, and there's just simply a very thin veil of human consciousness that it manifests through. But that is not separation from God. Because if God made everything, then where is he not? He must be in everything, of everything. Everything is made of God stuff. And that includes you, whether you are aware of it or not. But for those divinely awakened yogis, they are keenly aware of the divine nature of everyone that they meet. And through that conscious awareness, they help to quicken, they help them to awaken those ready souls who are ready to enter and merge into this divine consciousness, to help them through that final mile and bring them into that divine consciousness. And that is why Master came. So he had that open, expansive nature in which he wanted to bring everybody to God. And so he came to do big things in a worldly sense. He came to change this Western world. Vivekananda had come years before, as had other saints. But Master came and stayed, doing the hard work. He said that of all the thousands and thousands of people, people would line up around the block, waiting to hear him speak. But ultimately, he was disappointed, because in those days, movies were just coming in. But people came to see speakers from foreign countries and other places as a kind of entertainment and education, and as a way to get a flavor of somebody who was a bit exotic, perhaps. And they would come and they would get a certain experience with Master, but very few stayed to be loyal students, to become disciples. And so ultimately, he wanted to stop all of the touring, and he wanted to establish himself in a certain place. And when he saw the old Mount Washington Hotel that was no longer in use, used to be a cable car that got you up to the top of the mountain. That's how you got there. And he saw this, and he realized and got the immediate connection. This is one of the buildings he'd been seeing in meditation for so long, up on this hilltop. And just the day that, or the day before that he left the body, he asked to be driven around so that he could get that vision that he had had so many years before, through first through meditation and then actually seeing this old hotel that got transmuted into his hermitage. And he asked to be taken around to this vantage point so that he could see it silhouetted against the sky. And it was shining. It just had been painted white, a new paint job, and it was shining white against the blue sky. And he looked at it for a long time in silence, and I think relating back through those many years in which he first saw it in vision and then saw it in reality. But he didn't have any money to buy it when he first saw it. And so he scrambled around and to see whether he could get a loan or not, and that didn't seem to be forthcoming. And he needed a down payment, and somebody else was interested, and they were going to, he had it available to him for a certain amount of time, but that time was coming to an end, and then it would be open to anyone after that. And so that night, before it was to become free for this other person to purchase, there was a woman that had a dream, and she had had a large sum of money. And she was told in this dream, give this money to Yoganandaji. And so the next day she got in contact with him, let him know what her purpose was and that she was giving him this large piece of money, and it was enough money for him to go and make a down payment on Mount Washington. And so he was able to start the purchase, but you know, he had to keep it going. And it takes a lot of money to keep a large place like that going. And the Depression was just around the corner. And so there were a lot of lean times when he had to work really hard, and sometimes he had to tour in order to try to collect monies in order to keep everything going. And people who came, they wanted to be disciples, but of course they, in most cases, they were young. They didn't bring their own money. And so he had to support all of them as well. He says in India, they support the guru. But here, the guru has to support everyone else. And it's true. And so what a great, great struggle and strife he went through in order to be here to accomplish the work that he came to do. And that he had these open arms. He wanted everyone to come to God. If it was good for him, it was going to be good for everybody. And that's what he wanted. It was his whole nature. And so he gave us these wonderful writings. The Autobiography of a Yogi is still a bestseller today. And it's considered a spiritual classic. And there's just so much that he gave. What a wonderful, wonderful spiritual personality. Now, as I say, through our own guru lineage, we can see some serve very quietly. Master just exploded onto the world and had that expansive nature. So everybody operates in their own unique capacity. And some will be world shakers and others will just be very quietly realized, perhaps unrecognized by the world at large. I remember a story where devotees had said that Master had said, you go to see this one person. He's tremendously realized. Well, they went to his door. They knocked on his door. His house was in quite disarray. The man was rather large, overweight. He didn't look like anybody in particular at all. And they were surprised because Master had said, he is tremendous. And yet, to look at his surroundings, to look at him, you would never guess it. Mother talked about one day being out at Duval. She was in kind of an old antique-y kind of shop, if I remember the story correctly. And she was looking around. I believe she was out there with her daughter. Her daughter had driven her out there. And they were looking around, and suddenly she went up. The man was standing behind the counter. She was looking at some things behind the glass in the counter. And she looked up, and she looked into the eyes of this man, and she said the power of God in this man was just tremendous. Just tremendous. She had no idea. And he didn't have any of the appearances that you might take as someone who is totally God realized. When they asked Papa one time whether he knew whether anybody who came to him was God realized, he says, not always. I thought, well, if Papa doesn't know, then there's only one safe course, and that's to treat everybody as if they're completely God realized, because why would you want to mistreat anybody that you meet? And so it could be Babaji. It could be any of the great ones that you meet in any form. And when you look for and give the respect, the love of God in you toward everyone that you meet, you see, then even if that one is not manifesting God consciousness, it helps to awaken it in them. Think about the number of times that we talk about other people and the things that they've done wrong and the things that we find fault with. And just think the power of thought within you. If you are not helping to embed the those unlovely habits and thoughts and patterns into that person's consciousness. You're heaping it onto them. Rather than seeing God within them. And when you see God within them, then you add your power of thought to the awakening of God within them. You see, you can be a blessing or you can be a curse. And sometimes we can think that we're so above it all and we're so high and we're so mighty and we can look down on all creation, find fault with absolutely everyone and everything. But are we yet the paragon of virtue that we expect the rest of the world to be? And if we are not, then we are misdirecting our thoughts, our intentions, and our will. We have not yet come to that place where we can judge accurately. Jesus said an interesting thing. He says, I do not judge, but if I judge, my judgment is true. Well, which is it? Does he judge or doesn't he judge? And it is the truth both ways. Because he of himself does not judge, but the Christ consciousness that is within him and informing his own mind and his own intelligence, that will form judgment. And when that comes to him, he knows it's the truth because it goes beyond his own human capacity and goes directly to the divine consciousness, which is by nature, its own nature, connected to everything that is. So in the way that we guide our lives, we can be unique. We can be our march to our own drum and our own drum beat. But it's totally in tune with God if we have done our work. And God finds joy in manifesting. Just look at the multiplicity of life that there is. I was thinking one day from a Darwinian kind of standpoint that if all nature operated by that, it seems like that there would be a few predominant species, for instance, in the plant kingdom. Ivy or things like it would just take over and be everywhere. But look at the multiplicity. Look at all of the different kinds of flowers. Look at all the kinds of different things that we can manifest in our lives. And it's through this that we find our own God union. Because God is shining through those flowers. God is lifting everything. Have Larry close the door, please. God is manifesting through everything. He's manifesting through those flowers. He enjoys the multiplicity. He enjoys all the unique expressions. It's everything that we can hope to find, both for ourselves, an affirmation of our own selves, our own unique signature in God. So sometimes you think that if you find God union, that you'll become nothing, because we're talked about that you no longer have the human ego. But listen to what Mother says. Even the Christ used his five senses, because anyone in a human body must taste, smell, touch, see, and hear when he functions in the conscious state. However, he is not controlled by the desires created through the use of them, because he was master of himself and all that he surveyed. Such a one, regardless of himself and all that, and of his high state, must use his mind as long as he functions in a human body. The mind must be used both to illuminate the path and to destroy itself once this purpose is effected. What is left after all of these things have been accomplished is a spiritual ego, the self, or the capital S. Or to put it another way, the little human self, the Son of Man, has been changed and transmuted into his real or God self, and is now the Son of God, the Christ. Much of the personality and many of the habits peculiar to the personality remain as an automatic function. But because there is nothing left in the temple but the indwelling God, this is wonderful, isn't it, for Mother to describe it in this way. But because there is nothing left in the temple but the indwelling God, even these are divinized. The human within you has now been divinized. The fact that the human mind no longer exists does not mean that we function without a mind. Rather, it has been transmuted and absorbed into the universal mind and functions divinely in the state of cosmic consciousness. Many have said, like you, why should I destroy my ego? Of what value is it? I cannot conceive of such a thing because then I would be nothing. Let us remember the great ones who have destroyed their egos in order that they might become the saviors of mankind. Krishna, Buddha, Christ the Jesus, Muhammad, Zoroaster, in our own time, Ramakrishna, Ramana Maharshi, Ramdas, and our own beloved Guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, to name only a few. Were these non-entities? Nothings? They were and will be forevermore the greatest personalities the world has ever known. They chose to lose their lives, the human ego, centered only in the consciousness of the little self, that they might become saviors of the world. They will be remembered long after the kings, presidents, and others greats in the world have been completely forgotten. And so Master manifested this divine ego, and he came to awaken the same within us. You know, one of Master's disciples once said to me, one of the greatest statements of ignorance I've ever heard, which was, no gurus could come after Master, because that would be like someone standing and casting a shadow in front of the light. What a colossal state of ignorance. It's not like that. The individual who truly becomes illumined, now what he might be referring to is if somebody does that from an ego state, and he may not have known what is beyond the ego state. I think that's perhaps the truth. So he couldn't conceive that one who himself has become illumined in Christ consciousness would not be blocking Master's light, but adding to his light, as would each one who realizes God within themselves. And this is the most wonderful thing that you could possibly imagine, that it's each one, to whatever degree God chooses to manifest his light through them, adds more and more illumination to this world. How can that be a bad thing? It cannot. And to set Master up, as they have set up Jesus Christ as being the one and the only, is a place of ignorance. It is the human mind and material consciousness that has gotten hold of divine teachings and has completely distorted them. So let us wake up to our own divine nature. Let us learn what it is to surrender ourselves, body, mind, soul, completely and totally at the feet of God. As with Mother, when she pronoun to Master's feet. This was days after he left the body. He was laid out in a bed, and there were those who were meditating around him. And Mother had been meditating all night with the Master, and the sun was just coming up in the morning. And she touched her forehead to his feet. Now this mind is one who is no longer manifesting any signs of life. An electrical shock went out of his feet and through her ajna and all through her body. And it was just after she had uttered a prayer to Master that he take her life and use her in any way that he chose. And he did choose. He chose her. And he chose her to manifest his tremendous divine consciousness. Now we all may be blessed by Master even though he is no longer in the body. We may all be blessed by Mother, even though she no longer manifests a human body. This is the wonderful thing about spirit. It's not dependent upon a body. And so as we think on the Master's life, as we think on Mother's life or any of the great Master's lives, let us not just read the stories. Let us not just look from the outside as if we're looking through the glass window. But let us merge into that room from which they speak, from which they know, from which they see. Let us so become imbued with their radiance, their light, their love, that suddenly there doesn't seem to be any differentiation between human and divine, between I and thou, between you and me. But there is now only oneness, only oneness. Let us close with some chanting. With Om, Om Master. Om Master, Om Master, Om Master, Om Master. Om Master, Om Master, Om Master, Om Master. For bringing your light today.